she's already taken the podium, so I don't need to introduce her or call her forward anymore. So straight into the bio, she gave me a nice and short one because I think she's been happier often enough. Megan is actually an adjunct professor in the actuarial science at Wits University. She has written a number of articles for the South African Actuarial Journal, including one on ethics that forms the basis for today's workshop. So I think if you could talk us through that and maybe tell us how do we make the ethical decision about umbrella fund or not.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So following on from those discussions about professional issues, we now have one glorious hour of verifiable professionalism CPD standing between you and lunch. And the presentation is entitled Ethical Decision-Making and Employee Benefits or Making Decisions in the Gray. Now, given that we're going to be spending the next hour talking about ethics, now's a good time to actually define the term. So a definition of ethics that often gets bandied about is it's about doing the right thing. Now, common sense, the law and morality tells us that if we have one option that is right and one option that is wrong, we should do the right thing. It is wrong to take money meant for beneficiaries and transfer it into our own bank account. Okay, well, you don't need an hour lecture to tell you that that is the wrong thing to do. So ethics isn't particularly helpful in those contexts. Where ethics becomes particularly interesting is where you're weighing up decisions where neither of them are obviously wrong, or put differently, you've got two right options, and you're having to weigh up the right versus the right. And this is really what we're going to be exploring today. So, today we're going to cover three main things. Firstly, we're going to talk about the ethical theory. This is the part where we're going to learn all the fancy terminology so you can dazzle your colleagues back in the office. Then we're going to be talking about how we're going to apply all that theory to actual employee benefits. And finally, looking at a process for making ethical decisions in a retirement and an employee benefits context. Now, there's going to be plenty of interaction or opportunities for interaction. Just look for the raised hand icon. Fortunately, I also know a lot of your names, so that should help fill up the silences. So, moving along. Now, most controversial debates are controversial and, let's face it, interesting, because they're actually debates about two things, each of which could be considered right. And an ethicist called Kidder laid out four what he calls ethical tensions, or right versus right debates, which crop up very frequently. So the first one is truth versus loyalty. Now, this is one that we learn on the playground when faced with, you know, the choice of telling on our friend or keeping quiet, but it's also one that crops up in the workplace fairly often. So, for example, you're a consultant on a fund, maybe an umbrella fund, and your employer also provides administration services to this fund. You pick up an error which affected every member's fund credit. Happens. Fortunately, no member has left the fund, and this error can be corrected without the client ever knowing. Do you tell the client or just get it fixed? Would your answer change, and should your answer change, if members had withdrawn and been paid the wrong amounts? What else would change your answer? Any thoughts?
And if you don't see any hands, just put it in someone's face.
No takers? Okay, Sydney.
Yes, is there something like a loyal truth, maybe?
Well, I mean, the process of ethics is about weighing up the truth versus the loyalty. And for me, what I find really interesting about this debate is, you know, and having been in the position where you've had an error presented to you, the first question you ask is, well, have members been affected? But should that be the question you ask? Should we not be doing the same thing on a near miss relative to an event where members have been advantaged or disadvantaged? You know, from an ERM perspective and from an operational risk perspective, those two events are actually the same. But a lot of us would treat them differently. And maybe that's something to think about. The second tension is justice versus mercy. Now, this is really about doing what is objectively correct in terms of rules and procedures versus letting our own feelings and opinions influence our decision makers, our decision making. And this is an unfortunately familiar example. So a defined benefit fund has both active and pension members. Over the last few years, the pension increases have fallen below what is specified in their pension increase policy because the fund could not afford it. Suddenly, the fund is in surplus, allowing for the pension increases to be done, including the catch-up pension increases. So the surplus is strictly attributable to the active members. Should the trustees consider giving any of it as an ex gratia increase to the pensioners? Any takers? Arthur.
As Arthur else, I've been involved in this very much, and what I've learned is that pensioners are very short memories. So my answer here is a definite no, because if you give it out now, you're not going to get it back. So you've got to be fair from the beginning to everybody. They must get what the investments have earned. So the answer is definitely no.
Definitely no from Arthur. Anyone in the camp of the pensioners? I think Mr. Walker had opinions on this previously.
Okay, so since you're quoting me, I will have to now come out the closet and say yes. When we discussed this, I would say yes, because I worry very much about old people who can't do anything else. And so if it's all open and transparent, yes, I would be quite in favor of giving something to the pensioners just to help them survive. Especially because we're talking about DB active members. We're looking after them. They've got their guarantees in place. They're okay. It's the little old guys who can't afford to, you know, buy food at the end of the month. Those are the people I stress about the most. So, yes, I am in the opposite camp, quite right.
And there was a hand at the back as well. Shamil.
From our perspective, if the employer has an employee surplus account, the employer can surely decide how to divvy up that money. And in defined benefit arrangement, you still have, when it's surplus distribution, it doesn't all go to active members, it can go to the employer as well. So if the employer has surplus in his employee surplus account, he can surely allocate that to pensioners.
Okay, that was a nice compromise solution right there. So the third ethical tension is short-term versus the long-term. Needs no explanation. We have a great case study coming up with the introduction of two parts. So we want members to preserve for their retirement. And at the same time, we do recognize that they have often very pressing financial needs today, which they need to meet. So with that in mind, what is the right percentage of contributions to put in the accessible pot as opposed to the retirement pot? Don't worry about what the proposals are. What would be the right number if you controlled the world? Should we allow for transfers from the vested pot to the accessible pot, the so-called seed capital funding? Do we allow emergency access to the retirement pot? And what are we willing to concede in order to secure some form of compulsory preservation?
Okay, I'll start it off. So what is the right percentage of contributions to put into accessible pot? Nothing. So everything should be going to the retirement pot. There should be 100% compulsory preservation. Should we allow transfers from the vested pot to the accessible pot, so-called seeding capital? Preferably not. We would have been quite happy to, I'm going to be talking about this right at the end, but we as actuaries would have been quite happy to not have anything in terms of seeding capital. Do we allow emergency access to the retirement pot? Yes. So we got slammed in a public discussion by ASISA because we as ASSA were saying that we do believe that emergency access should be available to the retirement pot. So I would think that, just me personally, crazy Stephen, that everything should be going into compulsory preservation and you should have a flipping good reason why you need to be able to access that money, but you should be able to access that money. Your children are starving or your wife is lying sick in hospital, you need the money, there should be those opportunities given. Just from a practical perspective, that's unlikely to happen. What are we willing to concede in order to secure what we're going with, the one-third, two-third split? That's why we were, we'll give away the one-third because it's an acceleration of the commutable amount you're going to receive at retirement. Then at least we get this prize of two-thirds compulsory preservation. That's why we ended up in this position. That's me starting the input.
Anyone have a different view? Natasha.
But just to say that your seeding should be matched into accessible and your retirement pot. So if you want seeding, you've got to you've got to bring something, you know, 25 into there, 50 into the retirement, just to make you think about it.
Anyone with a different perspective? So something perhaps to think about is John had those statistics up earlier about the level of indebtedness of members in retirement funds. And, you know, ultimately we need to consider whether we're here to provide a comfortable retirement for people in terms of their entire balance sheet, or whether we're here to maximize what's in their retirement fund, because the two are quite different. Okay. Because if you have a member who's severely stressed, they are taking out those microloans, those unsecured loans. The interest rates on those things far exceed anything they're going to get from their retirement fund. You know, from a balance sheet perspective, it actually makes financial sense to allow members to tap into their retirement fund. Less convenient for administrators and asset managers. I mean, there are definitely disadvantages there. But this is really an important debate, you know, to grapple with in terms of what is the actual purpose of the retirement funds, but we'll head on to that one a little bit later. The final ethical tension is the collective versus the individual, and this is a really interesting one in terms of funds, because we often do have very diverse membership on a single fund. So, for example, a standalone fund is deciding about whether to move into an umbrella. A member trustee has skin in the game, both in terms of their own retirement benefits, but also in terms of the perks they receive because they are a trustee. Their needs as a member may also be very different from the average member. How much of this is understood when you're in the room, and how much should we actually be expecting trustees to disclose as a conflict of interest? Has anyone had a meaningful conflict of interest disclosure at a trustee meeting recently? Yes, Arthur.
Megan, I don't really understand this question. The standalone funds that I'm involved in, I have been involved in, member trustees are normally employees, so there's no additional benefit. In
there
fact,
may
it's
not be
strange.
Additional financial benefit to those members, but very often, and particularly in union funds, there's a lot of status attached to being a trustee.
Okay.
You know, yes. You get time off from your normal work. You get to sit in the meeting. There's tea. You get to rub shoulders with, you know, other important people in the organization.
Yeah, and I understand that. Thanks. And I'm not involved in those funds, so I don't really know.
So this is just something to remember when you are doing those conflict of interest disclosures, is that they don't necessarily have to be financial conflicts of interest. So in order to help us weigh up these ethical tensions, we're going to cover four major ethical theories, some of which have very fancy and very long names. The first of which is called the consequentialist theory of right action. Okay, and what that says is that if we want to judge whether an action is ethical or not, we can actually look at the action itself, and we can look at the outcome of that action. If the outcome is good, so the member outcomes that we're analyzing, if those look really good, it means that the action itself must have been ethical. This can be paraphrased as the end justifies the means. Related to that is the non-consequentialist theory of right action, otherwise known as deontology. So deontology also says we can evaluate the individual action, but instead of looking at the outcome, we need to look at the process that was taken to make that decision. And if all the necessary duties and obligations were fulfilled in terms of making that decision, then the action must be ethical. And in fact, deontology goes a little bit further, and it says, if you've ticked the box in terms of all your duties, there's the principle of sufficiency, which means the action is, by default, ethical. You know, you need to do no more than what's listed as your duties. So deontology really describes a view of the world which is about, you know, it's about the journey, not the destination. Then you have virtue ethics. Now, virtue ethics takes a step back and doesn't look at the action at all. It looks at the virtues that went into making that decision. So virtue ethics holds that a virtuous person would always make ethical decisions. So all we need to do to become ethical decision makers is we need to cultivate the right virtues, and then hey presto, all our decisions would be ethical. So very much tongue-in-cheek, but you know, to paraphrase, it would be, what would Mother Teresa do? And finally, we have the ethics of care. Now, this relates very much to some of the principles that John alluded to earlier and that Sydney alluded to. And the ethics of care is all about relationships. Okay, and that says that relationships exist between individuals in order to further meet the needs of the individuals. And we can evaluate the quality of relationships by the extent to which needs are met. And so, if we were to examine an action and how that impacts on relationships and the extent to which needs are met, and if the action improves the extent to which needs are met, the action itself must be ethical. So this really encourages people to look at stakeholders and the relationship between them. And to paraphrase, it would be, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Okay, so those are the four main ethical theories in a nutshell. Now, looking at these, some of these ethical theories you might really relate to. This might really correspond with your view of the world and how you make decisions in your day-to-day life. And some of them you might have a knee-jerk reaction to. And that's a function of many things. It's your upbringing, your religious persuasions, your past experiences, your general view of the world and education. And what's important to recognize is the person next to you may have a very different set of preferences to you in terms of how they would choose to make decisions. And the same goes for your trustees and even some of the members of the fund. So today isn't about personal ethics. Today is about ethics in employee benefits. So let's look at how we can apply these to actually ethical decision-making in retirement funds. So trustees are the ultimate decision makers on retirement funds. Fortunately, that isn't really most of us here. And trustees have a number of duties placed upon them by legislation, and they're up on the screen. So the first of those duties is the duty of care. So that means that trustees need to act in utmost good faith, in a prudent manner, and be diligent. This is often interpreted to mean that trustees must take as good care of member money as they would their own, or even better. The interesting issue is, to whom is this duty of care owned? It's not just to members, and it's not just to beneficiaries. It's actually to all stakeholders within the fund. The next duty is the duty of impartiality. Now, this is very interesting because it says that members should expect equal and objective treatment from trustees. However, you know, as John explained earlier, sometimes in order to get equal outcomes for people, we actually have to take very different actions for different groups. So sometimes ensuring best outcomes for members means that we actually can't be impartial and we can't treat all members equally. And this is the very reason why funds have member categories. Conflict of interest is defined as any conflict between personal goals and official duties. Obviously, enrichment of yourself or a close relative is wrong, but also sometimes there are non-financial benefits to being in the meeting at the trustee in the trustee meeting. Trustees also have a duty to act in accordance with the purpose of the fund. Now, the purpose of the fund is very often set out in the rules, but very commonly this is a very bland statement about how the fund is there to provide benefits on various events. It doesn't really give us much guidance as to priorities in funds. So, for example, how do we prioritize between risk and retirement benefits? How do we weigh up the needs of the few members who may die before retirement, leaving destitute family members, versus the majority of members who are going to live to see retirement age and who are not going to benefit from those risk benefits? In a similar vein, most infrastructure that we see around us is as a result of pension fund investments. Pension funds are the biggest investors in any economy. So to what extent should we be concerned about investing for members, in other words, maximizing what's in their retirement fund and worrying about just their retirement benefit? And to what extent should we be worried about investing for society, so considering the entire person and when they're going to be reaching retirement, what infrastructure they're going to see around them? Everyone likes the idea of SRI but hates the idea of prescribed investments, for example. So what are your thoughts? John had a lot to say about SRI earlier, so I might just pick on him. Or ESG, sorry.
No, thanks. Thanks for picking on me. I do think one needs to look at the bigger picture, and there are various trade-offs, because if you only look at things quite narrowly, you're not going to get the right outcome. So, for example, if you just look at maximize savings, well, we're not getting the right outcome. In fact, we're creating more pressure for people that are highly indebted, so they should have more education and focusing on paying off debts and then some minimum contribution, not maximizing it, but they still need some participation. Investing in the fund versus society, in my mind, are very linked. So if you do this correctly, and you every rand that you invest through a retirement fund, and you invest it sustainably in the economy, etc., it should have a financial return. I'm definitely not saying that we should invest for suboptimal returns, but it is possible, and the research has shown it, that you can invest and have dual objectives. You can have good returns and impact. So the job of the trustee should be to identify those areas that you can do both. And that's self-reinforcing, because if you have good impact, for example, good infrastructure, water, that underpins an economy which is good for your other investments. So these things are quite linked. So I don't think it's as binary as that. But if I had to pick, you need to have something that maximizes, that improves an individual's outcome, helps them to balance things on their journey, and invest in the economy that is circular, which is linked to ultimately improve their outcome. So these things are all linked. That's a food for thought for now.
Any other thoughts? Risk versus retirement. Who's had a debate on that one recently in your funds?
So I'm just going to repeat that quickly. Pension funds are role players in society. Investments should be deployed to improve society where possible, e.g. invest in SA economy rather than China. Now, I just want to add to that or ask the question, who does that then fall onto? Is it us as the advisors and the consultants? Is it the trustees? Is it the members who must elect trustees who will do this? Who's going to actually see to it, even if everybody agrees that that is the right answer, who's going to see to it that it happens?
Well, and actually accountability in decision-making is very important. I mean, John spoke a lot about metrics and measurement earlier. You actually do need to make decisions, and you need to say, well, and this is how we're going to measure whether this was the right decision. And sometimes not all the outcomes are necessarily financial. I mean, if we're talking about triple bottom line, some of the outcomes aren't, having good quality breathing air is not necessarily something we can put on a balance sheet, but it's something that people certainly appreciate in their day-to-day lives. And ultimately, this does fall on the trustees. It's incumbent on the trustees to actually have engaged with these issues.
But who's going to push the agenda unless you have a very proactive and a very trustee board or an individual on the board who's pushing these things hard? If it doesn't come from the consultants, nobody's going to raise it.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, John's got a point to make now. If you want to project, you can.
No, I think, look, that's a good point. Ultimately, it is the trustees as a body, and that's why you've got to make sure you've got the right skills around the table. Have you got the right mix of skills that look to the future? Understand things like cybersecurity, social investments, all these types of things? Or is it purely just actuary, legal? And because if you've got a very narrow focus without a bigger focus, you're going to get that. So I think the main thing, and it's the same thing for companies. Companies need to look forward, and they need to get the right skills to do the right things. And as much as you want members on the trustee board, I think you need to get specialist skills. And maybe these days the specialist skills are broader than just financial, legal, etc.
That's a very valid point, John, in terms of, you know, the fit and proper requirements and in terms of what you expect the trustees to bring to the table. But carrying on the discussion about the purpose of the fund, trustees have the duty to act in accordance with the purpose of the fund, but what if the purpose of the fund is unfair? Now, I'm sure we can all think of examples where purposes of the fund have been blatantly unfair. So for relatively recently, I saw a fund rule where a widower of a pensioner did not get a spouse's pension simply because of the wording of the rules, which had never anticipated a woman ever being a member of the fund and hence having a male partner for a pensioner. So there was no widower pension, there was just a widow's pension. You know, that's blatantly unfair. But sometimes the retirement fund can be unfair if considered in the context of the employer's large HR strategy. So it was a point that Steve mentioned earlier about, you know, employers are meant to have these benefits in order to you know, drive their employees in a particular way in order to, you know, distinguish themselves. But very often the retirement fund lands up doing the employer's HR department's dirty work. So, for example, the retirement age on the pension fund is very often what's used to push people out at a particular age in an employer because it's just easier than actually trying to work someone out in terms of HR processes. Similarly, if we look at vesting scales in the old days in DB funds, you know, it meant that when people withdrew, they typically left some of their money behind. Now, this fell disproportionately on female members in times when there was no maternity leave, because you simply had to leave all your money behind when you left the retirement fund. There was nothing in the rules that made the purpose of the retirement fund unfair, but the action of the retirement fund in conjunction with other employee benefits practices made that unfair. So the question is, how far do we have to look? You know, do we just have to look at the fund itself, or should we be looking broader? And it's difficult to know when to stop if you start looking broader. Trustees also have a duty of accountability. Arthur?
Megan, I'd just like to pick up that the purpose part. You asked early on the balance between risk benefits and retirement contributions. Mm-hmm. And I've got a real case. Early in my career, I went along with my Western attitude to a smallest church pension fund. I said, hang on, you're using half your contributions for the death benefit. And that's completely wrong. You're not looking down the road to retirement. They quickly explained to me in their culture, it's very important on the death of a member to set up to have a function for the family that invites everybody else that has meals, etc. And that is important in their culture. An employer was addressing the need in the culture in setting up the benefits in the fund. So I think when you look at that, the balance between the two, you can't just say, we need most of retirement. You've got to look at other factors as well. The culture, the employer, the members, etc., when you do decide on that balance.
Absolutely, and 100%. It might be very different for different funds, you know, particularly when you're looking, you know, weighing up long-term versus short-term, the individual versus the collective. Those balances might be very different for different groups. The duty of accountability is really about communication. So trustees have a duty to be accountable and communicate with the registrar, the FSCA, and with the pension funds adjudicator, as well as addressing any legal summons. That tends to get done. Communication to members and beneficiaries, well, as John pointed out earlier, that varies in terms of its impact and effectiveness. Importantly, the duty of accountability is also retrospective. So just because you're a new trustee and the old trustee board made a decision, you're on the hook for it now. The duty to whistleblower is relatively new, and I have to point out if whistleblowing were easy to do, we wouldn't need to make it a duty, and we wouldn't need to provide whistleblower protections. The duty arises on specific events. So, for example, late contributions into retirement funds, which is the biggest one of the big problems on that private sector security pension fund. And, you know, paying contributions late is wrong because it's essentially taking an interest-free loan from your members without their knowledge or consent. But trustees often find themselves extremely conflicted when they need to actually report this. So firstly, sometimes the trustees are the actual people at the employer making the decision not to pay the money over. So obviously as individuals, they're not going to turn themselves in. And then the other trustees are conflicted because this is someone they sit on a board with all the time. Are they really going to turn this person over? Sometimes trustees are scared because they didn't whistleblow previously or they didn't make disclosures previously, and now they're worried this is all going to come out if they start making disclosures now. And very often they just are hoping that the administrator is just going to make this problem go away. And sometimes those late contributions are what's actually keeping members in their jobs. So if you have member trustees, they might have a very, very vested interest not to push that envelope too hard. So this is a very, very difficult, it sounds great in theory, but it's a very, very difficult thing to get done in practice. And I certainly know a number of actuaries feel pretty frustrated by the limited effect that the whistleblowing tends to have on this behavior. The final duty is that of being fit and proper. This means undergoing a certain level of training, and as John mentioned, maybe we need to think about that training more dynamically, as well as trustees passing tests of honesty and integrity. So most of us are not trustees, fortunately, and we don't have all those duties placed upon us, but we need to be aware of them when we're advising the trustee boards. You may also have employer codes of conduct placed upon you. And if you're ever in a position to whistleblow, I would, from personal experience, strongly suggest that you contact your internal legal department first to make sure that you're not breaking any other laws, and importantly, to make sure that you actually have the protection of a whistleblowing disclosure, because that's not necessarily automatic. And then finally, we have professional codes. So as members of ASSA, we are required to act with honesty, integrity, due care, and diligence, and to uphold the profession and the profession's values. So let's take this all back to our ethical theory. How does this all tie in? So the repeated mention of duties should make you all think of deontology, okay? Because if we do our duties, the action is automatically ethical. However, a number of those duties are also virtues, okay? Duties of care, okay? Duties of, you know, being fit and proper. So they are virtues, so they should make us think about virtue ethics. And similarly, they are relational. So to whom is the duty of care owed? To whom are we accountable as trustees? What should members expect from trustees? So it's relational, which should also make us think of the duty of care. Now, the one thing that doesn't come into it really is the theory, consequentialist theory of right action. The pension fund adjudicator has made it quite clear that it's not actually the outcome that they're worried about, it's the process that the trustee boards have gone through in order to reach their decision. So going back to our, you know, should we disclose where there's no harm done to members, you know, the pension fund adjudication should probably would go yes. So how do we relate this back to decision making? You know, is there a way that you can make decisions within a retirement fund so that if you're later accused of unethical action, the trustees can actually defend themselves? So the quick answer is yes, this is just one possible way that you could do it, which is based on the actuarial control cycle, which should be familiar from your exams, although for some people it was further ago, long ago than others. So the first step is to identify the ethical dilemma, and I can't overemphasize the importance of this step. So most major ethical failings that you hear of or things that became case studies, the person involved didn't even think it was an ethical issue to begin with. So you actually need to stop and think, well, is there an ethical issue here? And also what's very clear to one person, so very black and white issues to one person might be a very murky gray to another. And your trustee board is made up of disparate individuals. The whole point of the trustee board is you're meant to have a diversity of opinion on it. So it is helpful to state explicitly, okay, we're going to make this decision. What are the ethical implications of it? It's very helpful to state those the issue in terms of those ethical tensions that I mentioned earlier, because if you're phrasing something in terms of a right versus right, it really does open up the discussion because you've made it clear from the outset that there isn't actually a wrong answer here, which should hopefully get the conversation going. And you know, if you're into your ERM, you probably want to also identify the intensity of the risk and the numbers affected right at the beginning, because you really, you know, if there are one or two members who are affected by it, but affected in a very severe way, it then becomes an ethical decision as to how much time we're going to give this issue. Are we going to worry about the 80%, or are we going to worry about the 20% for whom the one size fits all doesn't work? The second step is to develop the solution. So this means to gather information, and where this is a specific duty of trustees, the duty of diligence is required. So this might mean a fairly extensive search of information. So what kind of information? Well, that is subject to interpretation. So you could go the hard data analytics route with, you know, combined data sets and, you know, data from outside the fund and inside the fund. You could just be using the fund information, whereas some other trustees might want you to do focus groups with members and surveys and, you know, more on the touchy-feely side. All of that is actually considered information. And also bear in mind that the pension fund adjudicator is a lawyer. You know, it's important to bear that in mind. The third step is to understand the environment, including legislation and regulation. And unfortunately, this is very often the only thing that gets considered. You know, we're like, are we good with the law? Yep, sure, let's go ahead. Unfortunately, checking that something is legally possible or in line with regulation is a necessary but not a sufficient condition. So what, for example, if the law is unfair? So, you know, we've said earlier that trustees need to challenge the purpose of the fund, but what about the law? So earlier we had the example of a Section 14. Should people really be challenging that and going, well, this is a really unfair regulatory process that is here? If we go back to retirement funds and issues within the trustees' control, you know, in most funds, you have group risk, which is priced taking the sex profile of your membership into account, but every member pays the same premium. Maybe you might have some age-related premiums, maybe, okay? But when we get to retirement, suddenly the sex of the member matters very much in terms of what they're actually going to buy in terms of the annuity. It's legal, but is it fair? Similarly, is it fair that most DB funds have a spouse's annuity benefit? It's a joint life benefit that gets given by default. But 40% of women reach retirement unpartnered. You know, what about those people who are never going to use the benefit but are paying for it anyway? All that is legal, but is it fair? What are your thoughts on the unisex annuity pricing before DSD makes it our reality? Anyone had clients who've looked at annuity pricing recently? No one? Clearly I'm standing between you and your lunch. Okay. Oh, there's one at the back, Andrea.
Thank thanks. So I won't leave you hanging there. Maybe a spoiler alert for my upcoming presentation, but the relevance of sex as a rating factor was something that was discussed at the ICA as well. And interestingly there, the conclusion, specifically from some of the other nations, was that maybe it is not an appropriate rating factor to use anymore because of how it's changed over time and the fact that it is no longer something that doesn't change. It's not static, you know. There's a lot of issues with using it. It's undefined. People don't want to disclose it necessarily, and it's not necessarily only male-female anymore. So definitely an interesting discussion topic is the relevance of sex as a rating factor, and it seems that the world is moving towards unisex.
Well, a lot of Europe moved to unisex pricing, you know, over a decade ago.
Thanks, Meg. On one of the African funds I work on, we're in the valuator. So they did remove gender when it came to the annuity pricing because of discrimination. You know, this is discriminatory. They then later took it even further and said using age is also discriminatory against, and this is ageism as well. So they removed gender and age, which, as you can imagine from the point of view of the valuator, it's not very financially sound. It's also sometimes important to find that balance as well, you know, between making things fair but making things financially sound, you know. And as the valuator, probably have to look at both, right? But our focus is certainly on the financial soundness.
Well, I mean, and that brings us back to that tension between the individual and the collective. You know, because you're pricing for annuities on an individual basis, but ultimately, if it's financially unsustainable, that falls back on the rest of the fund. You know, it's, and we are in this group together. So the question of, you know, how much underwriting is the correct amount of underwriting to apply is actually quite controversial. You know, for example, you know, in the group space, we rate on income, you know, for annuities, but in the retail space, you know, your income isn't actually taken into account. So we don't necessarily have appropriate pricing for blue-collar workers. You know, again, it's all entirely legal. The question is if it's fair. So step four is to look at developing the solution. So this looks at evaluating possible options. Now, along the way, you might have picked up some compromise solutions while you've been going through this, and so it's important to recognize that your decision set isn't necessarily static in the process. And then you can just quickly run it through a five-point checklist. Is it consistent with the law? The purpose of the fund, does it show the right balance of justice versus mercy? What does it do in terms of the relationships in the fund? And a big actuarial keyword, cross-subsidies. Now, who are the winners and the losers from making this decision? And do there have to be winners and losers? And are we comfortable with who's winning and who's losing? Because very often it's not the cross-subsidy itself that's the problem, it's the direction of the cross-subsidy, which makes people uncomfortable. And then to consider the virtues, and in particular the virtues expected from the actuary in terms of the actuary's code, in terms of your employer code of conduct, and in terms of the duties placed on the trustees. And finally, make a decision. Okay, now, obviously, sitting around and talking about it for 6 months to make sure that you've ticked every possible box is also making a decision. Okay, and so funds need to be able to do this process quickly, but also to have effective deadlock-breaking mechanisms. I think a personal professional low point was having a client who was having very heated debates about amending their pension increase policy, which the employer decided to expedite by playing with the thermostat in the room and fiddling it from about 10 degrees up to about 30 degrees and back again. And then after about 4 hours, the tea and coffee and all refreshments were removed from the room, while the temperature just went up and down for another 4 hours. So hopefully your funds have better deadlock-breaking mechanisms than that. But once a decision is made, it needs to be actioned and accountability taken for actioning it. Now, very often this just falls on the poor old principal officer, but, you know, trustees do have skills themselves and should be made and are accountable for that action actually being taken.
And it's really important to communicate that decision to members. Now, John has spoken earlier today about communication, you know, how we can tailor it and nuance it to members. But how many of your funds have considered the ethics of communication? Okay. Who knows if every member of every one of their funds can read? Okay. Who knows if every member of their funds has access to a smartphone? Or can read English? Okay. And this is one of the major issues with communication and funds, because what can work really nicely for 80% of the members, you still have a group of members for whom it might not work. And how do you actually do that? Not every employee sits at a computer, you know, so has equal access to email. Not every employee actually knows how to use email or even has a work email address. So a lot of funds, when they're developing this, you know, really need to think in terms of some of the basics, like USSD. You know, it isn't sexy, but it gets to every member. Okay, and members are able to action it immediately in real time, even if they don't have data, which can be a really important thing. Because the problem is, if you send someone something and at that moment they're busy or they don't have data, chances are it's never actually going to be done. And it can be in very subtle things as well. So, for example, idiom. You know, idiom is very much language-based and culture-based, and so an idiom that might make perfect sense to me might make no sense at all to someone else. I had one client once who, the way they did communication was they did a presentation without any words. The entire thing was pictorial. And then they dubbed it in all official languages, plus some others, which some of their members had, because the nature of their business was not all of their members were from South Africa. You know, and that was still very challenging. To find an image that means exactly the same thing to every language and culture can be very, very tricky. You know, so Unilever once put together an advert for a washing powder, which they were convinced was going to work in every country. And it was very simple. On the left, you had a pile of dirty laundry. Then you had the box of said detergent. And then you had clean laundry on the line. That worked fantastically, except for the Arab countries where they read from right to left. And suddenly their entire campaign came down. And sometimes it's really important to remember that we have equivalent issues in retirement. You know, not everyone's going to view the communication the same way. And the sixth step is to monitor the solution. And this is where accountability comes into it. Now, very often, trustees might not make the best decision first time round. Okay, and it's fairly unrealistic to expect that we have perfection with every decision. But how easy is it for trustees to actually reverse a decision without losing face and without feeling like they're encouraging a legal challenge? So in a sense, that's a culture change needed within the retirement fund. And if a decision isn't correct, you need to be able to review it and to review the process if absolutely necessary. So that's all the theory. We actually have time for a case study. I am aware that I'm standing between you and lunch, and I'm picking on the data analytics just because I knew John was going to do a good job of it earlier. So, you know, we've heard about, you know, data analytics, and we've got all these fantastic tools available to help us do data analytics on funds. What are the ethical implications of including this on an open occupational DC fund? So starting at the beginning, okay,
what sort of ethical tensions are going to arise? If you're sitting in a trustee meeting, someone has suggested this. Okay. Is this a truth versus loyalty thing? One nod? No? Okay. Is it a long-term versus short-term? Possibly, you know, because if we start, Hanre's nodding there, you know, because if we start collecting data now, when are we going to use it? And Arthur, you know, made a comment to me earlier when we were talking, you know, there's the issue of who's going to pay for this? Okay, this isn't free. Someone's still got to collect the data. You've got to often pay for data, particularly if it's good. Who's going to pay for the governance overlay in this? And who's going to benefit from this? Any thoughts coming through on the chat? Gosh. Any thoughts about individual versus the collective?
If I may, perhaps, is there concern that if you now have all this masses of data and it gives you answers that you don't like or doesn't appear fair or doesn't appear, like the annuity question, if the evidence is there that it's fair to price according to X, Y, and Z, and now to discard that, you've gone through all the effort, and now you discard that whole piece of information, again, either to the groups or to the individuals' disadvantage. So if you go down this route, then it must be to use the results.
Well, I mean, that is a really interesting issue. So I forget which tech company it was which landed up in this problem. And they used an AI algorithm for their hiring process. And it was very spiffy because you could put all these things in and would spit out a shortlist of candidates who would suit the company's culture. You know, it was based on, you know, what was there already. And, you know, it seemed to be really good. This was going to streamline their hiring immensely. And it actually became a bit of a problem because after, not initially, but after a couple of weeks, they started noticing that all the candidates it put through were male. 100%. Okay? Because what it was doing was it was looking at who's already there. And was going, well, based on these people, none of these people went to women-only colleges. Okay, so any applicant from a women-only college, which is quite common in the US, we're just going to discard. You know, happy days. So unfortunately, they then later got into a lot of trouble because of this algorithm. Now, the problem with, you know, using analytics without human interaction, without the value add, you know, of human judgment is that you can land up with answers that really don't make sense. And it's one of the huge debates with AI is that you can tell it to maybe say not use race or maybe not use gender. But then what it will do is we'll find all sorts of other things which are close proxies to those things. So you land up in exactly the same position you would have been had you used those factors. To begin with. So there's a huge requirement for having human value add. Like you can't just chuck it in a machine and hope you're going to get an answer out that's actually going to be worthwhile. I mean, there are also issues here in terms of past versus future, because you're going to have to do this frequently enough that actually it's relevant to the current generation of members making decisions. Okay, but you're going to have done a decent job of actually looking what other factors are potentially conflating your data. So you've got a conflict there between, you know, spending time and making sure that you've caught all the nuance and getting it out quickly so it still remains relevant. I mean, it's a lot of your segmentation there depends on your credibility of your data. So, you know, you should all remember this from your A311. I've marked it recently, which is why it's top of my mind. You know, you need enough data for something to be credible, but you don't want to spend so long accumulating that data that actually it's no longer relevant. So the size of your fund really matters. On a small fund, your data analytics, well, you know, they might be interesting, but the law of small numbers isn't particularly helpful. We need to deal with big numbers. The more you segment, the more you get very small cells, and the more you segment, the closer you get to privacy issues. You know, because there might only be one or two people in your fund who match a certain characteristic that you've put out there. So in theory, you haven't named anyone, but you know, in terms of if someone from the employer saw that, they would probably figure out who it was very, very quickly.
I've got another comment here from Johan Geldner saying that collecting data, and I think even at this granular level that you're talking about now, maybe that's different, but you shouldn't have any impact as long as the trustees have a clear idea of what it will be used for and that there's an expectation that it will be beneficial for the group as a whole. So he believes if everybody understands the means to an end, nobody will object to sharing their data. I agree with the principle. In reality, my view is people often act very irrationally. We saw with the whole COVID story how people do things that you just go, what? Why are they doing that or not sharing that or not doing this? And just to being beneficial to the group doesn't mean that every individual will sign up for it.
And I think that's true. I mean, it's very difficult to opt someone in, you know, automatically to sharing information and then allowing them to opt out. I mean, you can do it, but in terms of Poppy, you need to be very careful. I mean, another issue is also, you know, there's the issue of phishing. You know, we might know that certain information is relevant. So, for example, the amount of unsecured debt you have, the amount of credit card debt you have, you know, what your balance sheet looks like. What about other information? I mean, maybe the car that you drive, you know, has something to do with your statistics. Interestingly, brown-eyed batsmen have higher averages than blue-eyed batsmen. Okay? It's true. Okay? But, you know, one wouldn't necessarily want to set out asking those sorts of questions. There's a correlation there, but is there necessarily a causation? Okay, and that's where one needs to be quite careful with the data analytics, because we can't see causation from data. We can see correlation. Causation is very difficult. And that distinction, I see John nodding very sagely at the back, you know, that distinction between causation and correlation might be quite intuitive to us, but for trustees, might be less so. Okay, so that brings me to the end. If you've got any questions, I'm happy to take them. Otherwise, you can email me. And as was said at the beginning, this came from a published paper, so I need to give credit to my co-authors, Taryn Reddy and Roseanne Harris. That's me.
Thank you, Megan. Thank you very much. And thanks to everybody else that participated in this morning session. You got us to lunch. Thank you very much. I think if we stay behind for cocktails, you may hear a couple of the opinions that people held for themselves. Because I'm sure they do have opinions on the things that you asked. So thank you very much. We appreciate it. We'll see everybody else back at 13:45. So 45 minutes lunch. Enjoy the break. Thank you.